And we begin this hour, as most of the millions do each day in this city, in a traffic jam. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry in Mexico City. Thanks so much for listening to our adventures in this city of gridlock and traffic, this economic powerhouse in Latin America, with some lessons to teach the rest of the world. Hey, Todd, up there in New York, can you name this tune?
John, isn't that Smoke on the Water? Is there a Spanish translation for Deep Purple?
No. It's a universal language of heavy metal, that's for sure. You know, it's been really interesting here in this city, which is so huge. You know, I think it could swallow New York. You would love it down here, Todd Zwillick. I think it might make you miss the Beltway.
Well, you know, John, the rapidly expanding Beltway region is, for as big as it is only 3.5 million people. I think I read yesterday the city you're in is 14 million people.
14 in the regular sort of central area, 21.2 in the metro area. And we've been experiencing a real sense of this city's problem-solving mentality in the midst of all that. There's a building boom. Hard hats are the biggest fashion statement around here. This city is serious about sustainability. We'll have some conversations about that over the next few days. And I'll introduce you later this hour to an artist who turns guns into musical instruments, like that electric guitar you just heard.
And I wonder if turning guns into musical instruments isn't an economic powerhouse for the United States. I mean, most of the guns down there come from the good old US of A, don't they, John?
You're so right, Todd. And I think our artist friend Pedro Reyes would love to turn that traffic around and sell these musical instruments back to the USA.
Maybe we can give them fewer guns and more Fenders, I guess.
Nice idea.
Well, whether it's guns or Fender guitars, when it comes to the U.S. economy, the bottom line is a sale's a sale, right? And here's a headline that may surprise you. The federal budget deficit is shrinking. Now, what's more, it's shrinking far faster than anyone in Washington thought it would. And here's part of the reason why. U.S. GDP numbers out from just earlier this morning. The U.S. economy grew at 2.4% in January to March quarter, helped by strong consumer spending. That's from the AP. All helping the bottom line and all helping the deficit. Well, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the budget deficit will shrink this fiscal year to $642 billion. That sounds like a huge number, and it is, but that's just 4% of our gross domestic product. That would bring it back to 2008 levels. And to put that in perspective, in 2009, the budget deficit wasn't $642 billion. It was $1.4 trillion. So for a bit of perspective on how the deficit started to shrink and what this really means, by the way, it's not all good news, right, Charlie Herman?
Unfortunately, it's not. I mean, this is actually a pretty remarkable event that you are seeing the deficit actually come down. And in a way, it's not that unanticipated, because there's a couple things going on here. One, the sequester. The federal government is spending less money than it was originally expecting to do so. So as a result, when it spends less money, it's taking on less debt.
Why are they spending less? Is that the sequester that we hear so much about?
It's the sequester, exactly. And then when you combine with that the government is actually bringing in more money than it expected, about a 15% increase in the amount of money that it's bringing in from taxes. And what you're seeing on this taxes is it's everything from the payroll tax. If you remember back in December when we were worried about the fiscal cliff, what would happen with this payroll tax going up 2% for all Americans who get a paycheck? Well, that went through, and so the government is collecting more money. At the same time, there was this big rush by really wealthy taxpayers to try and take advantage of tax benefits because their taxes were going to go up in the start of 2013. So they did a lot of things in 2012 to try and take advantage of lower tax rates. That still led to more money being collected by the government. And now, by the way, the tax rates are higher. Then you also add into the fact that corporations are doing well. They're bringing in a lot more. They're paying a lot more taxes.
They've actually been doing well the whole time, all the way since 2009, haven't they?
They've been doing well, you know, by and large, when you look at them as a whole, and they've been, you know, paying more money into the Treasury. So when you add in the fact that the government is taking in more money and at the same time it's not spending as much, well, then that's why you're not seeing as much of a deficit and you're seeing this reduction.
Charlie Herman is business editor at WNYC. Charlie Herman, what about those GDP numbers that I just mentioned? 2.4%, that's growing and doing a little bit better. below what economists like it to be, which is around 3% usually. But good consumer spending helps drive down the deficit, right? There's a follow-on effect when more money is in the system.
Well, first off, there's a general consensus by a lot of economists and by others that if we hadn't have had the sequester and if the tax rates hadn't have gone up, if we hadn't had the fiscal cliff that we did sort of go over a little bit, that we might see stronger growth, that instead of 2.4%, that it could be above 3%. But whatever the case, this is the situation we're in right now. That report that came out this morning did show that consumers were spending. And this is a little bit of a surprise to a lot of people who really watch consumer spending, because they thought that with the payroll tax going up, meaning that Americans were taking home less money each week or every other week, that they would not spend as much. And in fact, that hasn't necessarily been the case. They've been spending pretty well. Consumer confidence report came out this week. It's at a five-year high. You know, part of this may be because housing prices are going up, the stock market's going up. There's a thing called the wealth effect, where you begin to feel better about, you know, how well you're doing when you see these indicators. Even if you may not own a home or you may not own stock, it's just a general sense that, oh, the economy's doing better, I'm feeling better. And the other big thing to point out here is gas prices really haven't risen like we normally see this time of year. So as a result, a lot of consumers may be feeling that they do have more money in their pocket and feeling a little more confident.
Now, if you've spent the last 3 years, like most of us have, including myself, knowing that the debt is out of control, the national debt, and all of a sudden that you hear news that the deficit is a lot smaller than anybody thought, and there's some sunlight on the horizon, you get really confused really quickly. We're not talking about the debt. And I said it's not, at the top, it's not all good news. The debt is still a major problem.
So let me be the Debbie Downer now. So the deficit, this is, you know, on a monthly basis, the government, what it brings in and what it spends, that's going down. That's what we were talking about before. It was over $1 trillion. Now it's expected to be about $640 billion. That money gets added to the bigger pot, the debt. And so what you have there is that debt continues to grow. It is a real problem, especially when you start looking out to like 2023, 2024, way far out. But that's when you really see this huge, you know, demographic change, where thousands, millions of people are going to be going onto Social Security. They're going to need more Medicare, that more money by the government is going to be necessary for entitlement programs. And then, you know, the reality is that some of these issues need to be dealt with now. But if the economy is looking well, if the government's not spending as much, there may not be as much incentive for politicians to really try and deal with it. And, you know, we're going into the election. So.
Right. And you're talking about that old trope of the grand bargain, solving the long-term problems of demographic shift, Social Security, Medicare, and spending.
It makes it a lot harder to deal with that when you see
if the deficit numbers are coming down.
Yeah. If those numbers are coming down, then you begin to feel, oh, this is beginning to resolve itself. And we may not need to, you know, we still need to tackle it, but it's not as pressing as it was before. We don't have this debt ceiling or a fiscal cliff or something that if we don't resolve it right now, we're going to go off the rails.
You'd be wrong to feel that way, however. That's sort of your point, that the debt is still a major problem. And if anybody in Washington is starting to feel like the pressure is off and that they don't really need to do something, the politics of the moment may not match the long-term needs of the country is what
exactly. And, you know, we have to keep in mind that as the economy, if it continues to do better, the Federal Reserve has taken some really extraordinary measures to try and help the economy, especially in the absence of policies and you know, action by the federal government. I mean, some of these things that are going through are more by default, like the sequester cuts in a way were set up by Congress and, you know, defaulted to a lot of these cuts. Same thing with the expiration of the payroll tax going up at the beginning of January. So at a certain point, the Federal Reserve, though, which has been very active in trying to jumpstart the economy, will decide at some point, look, the economy is doing pretty well. We're going to slow down some of these actions we've been taking to try and get the economy going. And, you know, a big concern is, do people confuse that with, oh, my God, they think the economy is growing too fast. They're trying to slow down the rate of economic growth. Let's, you know, sell our stocks. Let's make a lot of other changes. You know, there is a point where we need to get back to some sort of normalcy, whatever that may be. And so it could be a little bit of a bumpy road ahead. And of course, you know, we're not great at long term planning, but we really do need to think out that what's happening to the overall debt, which is, you know, quickly approaching $17 trillion.
Charlie Herman, WNYC business editor. Charlie, the one economic number that everybody really cares about, they care about all these, but the really big one is employment. And unemployment is still higher than we want it to be. It's lagging. They say it's a lagging indicator, But does this good news today portend any actual good news for jobs?
Well, I mean, we've been seeing, you know, some pretty steady job growth in the couple months of this year. That new number will be coming out next week. Yes, that's one people will clearly be paying a lot of attention to. But we just haven't seen solid job growth, even as the economy has been doing well. And that's going to be a fundamental problem. That needs to get fixed before things really take off.
The economy doing better, GDP at 2.4% growth, we learned this morning, and the federal deficit down to $642 billion, way lower than $1.4 trillion in 2009. But employment next week is really what matters. So says Charlie Herman, WNYC business editor. Charlie, thank you.
Thank you.
This is John Hockenberry down in Mexico City, and traffic is what people talk about here in this place of sprawl and history, humanity and density. How long will it take to get from point A to point B, people ask. And the cabbies will always volunteer a prediction, but the really wise folks shake their heads and say, I don't know, it depends on the traffic.
If we don't get cities right, the whole planet will go off the cliff.
At an MIT-sponsored conference here this week, they are talking about intelligent cities. Kent Larson of the MIT Media Lab says high-density places, places with traffic jams, are in fact the most efficient places in the world, but they just have to get smarter.
Cities are the solution. I really do believe it's where most of the wealth will be created. It's where most of the ideas will come from. It's where women will find equality, and a high-density city is an incredibly efficient machine.
Here on the campus of Mexico's version of MIT, in a building that's painted orange on the outside and hot pink on the inside, people like architect Niels von Downing have hope. Van Downing is working on a project to make streetlights intelligent, to dim when no one is around, to save energy. He says the options for cities that want to change have never been greater.
Cities have to evaluate their priorities carefully and not be driven by sometimes megalomaniac ambitions that you see in some of the cities on this planet. When you involve your citizens actively in setting those priorities, you can achieve great results.
Sustainability, all these scientists say, is about mobilizing the genius of the citizens to make changes that everyone can have a stake in. MIT's Carlo Ratti says you can even recreate the creative vitality of Silicon Valley in a place like Mexico City, because other big cities have done the same.
I think everybody is astonished by what New York and the mayor achieved in just a few years, you know, and how New York has been now a real competitor to Boston and to San Francisco for this type of activity.
Traffic is something of a metaphor for this city of hope that's also on edge. As you travel from neighborhood to neighborhood, the contrasts are astounding. Blink and a barrio becomes Beverly Hills. Gated splendor becomes gated squalor. Stucco buildings covered with ivy become walls covered in graffiti. You glimpse the past here in this city that has been around since the 1300s and has become the largest Spanish-speaking city in the world. Everything reused, repurposed, new money living in old buildings, sustainability, recycling. You might say Mexico City has been doing that for centuries. Todd?
Thanks, John. That's great. John Hockenberry is in Mexico City for the rest of this week. I'm Todd Zwillick here in New York. This is The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry in Mexico City. And there's one person here who, when he talks about sustainability, people really listen. He's the man who won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1995 for his work on chlorofluorocarbons. Mario Molina won the Nobel Prize for figuring out that industrial compounds would destroy the Earth's ozone layer. CFCs from aerosol products were threatening the planet. He sounded the alarm. A chemist who helped save the planet, now he's trying to help save Mexico City from itself. Since Dr. Mario Molina won his Nobel Prize, he's been leading an effort to keep the air above Mexico City clean and the growth of this city of more than 21 million sustainable. Question number one, can a city of this size survive?
It is a very big challenge, and it's a question that when I was still a professor at MIT, we decided to address as an example of interdisciplinary work, because it requires not just chemistry, but social sciences, economy, and of course other sciences as well, meteorology and so on and so forth. But the challenge is enormous, because it's indeed very many people, and we're trapped in a valley. However, it is possible, even for such a large city, to clean the air. And simultaneously, not just look at the environmental component in isolation, but it's coupled to other aspects of the functioning of the city, like the transportation, to the extent that the city gets jammed and with congestion, there is more contamination, but also less efficiency. People spend hours just getting from one place to another. That's not an efficient city. So more recently, we've recognized very explicitly that to deal with problems like Mexico City, we need to work with issues that have to do with the economy, social issues as well, to make the city attractive, and the environmental issues, that is what guarantees, of course, sustainable development so that it actually lasts.
How would you say Mexico City is ahead of other cities of its size in the world, Beijing, Lagos, some cities in the United States, and how is it behind, do you think, some of those cities?
I think Mexico is ahead in many cities in terms of recognizing the nature of the problem and recognizing that it takes a concerted effort, again, a collaboration between government and society responding to these types of measures. We are certainly behind in Mexico City in terms of making a very livable city. There are many possibilities to making it a green city, more parks, but also what we call to recovering the public space so that one can actually wander in the city. This is beginning to happen, for example, in the central part of Mexico, the historical center that was recognized, and so there are some streets where cars are not allowed, it's just for pedestrians. And of course, this is not new. That's something that Mexico City could copy out of the success of other cities. But what is new is the fact that it's huge and that these sort of things can be implemented. I would mention one more thing as a scientist. We used Mexico City, because of its size and the enormous amounts of emissions, as a laboratory. So we were able to carry several projects, field experiments involving scientists from all over the world to better understand the nature of the pollution, which is complicated chemistry, actually. And we were actually quite successful there. So I think what was learned in terms of how a polluted city functions, how these chemicals affect air quality, was probably and is still being very useful for all the cities in our planet.
Finally, when you won the Nobel Prize, did you win the Nobel Prize for chemistry or for saving the ozone layer?
Well, I was not part of the committee that decided, but I believe in the tradition of the Nobel Prize, it was a combination, because it was the science was important. It was basic science, fundamental science, but applied to a societal problem. And in fact, I was surprised when I received the news, because there were really no precedents for Nobel Prizes for global environmental issues. But fortunately, the precedent is there now. And it means, going back to our earlier question, that it is quite possible and quite important, in fact, to connect applied science to these values of humanity that we were talking about. And many Nobel Prizes are strictly done for the very fundamental science, but I recognize that some of them, certainly the Peace Prize, yes, but in the sciences, it's less common to sort of directly involve the societal issues. Although, let me give you one more example. The discovery of the laser, okay, has enormous benefits for society. It's a Nobel Prize, but when it was discovered, it was a very fundamental, very abstract finding that it was at that time hard to predict how much benefit for society it would have. So along those lines, let me just finish by saying that what's important with Nobel Prizes is to focus attention on the importance of science for society and the fact that it can be applied for the betterment of society.
Well, you've done both. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Well, here are some numbers. 1 in 3 Netflix subscribers watched the newly released 4th season of Arrested Development this past weekend. And if those two did, get this, 1 in 10 watched all 15 episodes in a single day. This kind of binge watching has become commonplace with other shows. Think of House of Cards, 24, which was tailor-made for binge watching. The granddaddy of all binge shows, which I am currently binging on, Breaking Bad. Last year, the viewers tried watching Breaking Bad on Netflix. 73% binge watched the entire first season of those who started in on the show. Now, for me, also, here's the granddaddy, my granddaddy maybe, of all binge watch shows. Listen.
Wow.
Okay, it was good.
That's so well done.
Do we have time to watch one more, you think?
I think so. So good.
What time is it?
It's like daylight already. Do you want to watch more?
My vacation day starts now. Okay, let's just watch the first episode of season 2. Yeah, okay, thanks. Bye. So, I lost my job.
One more episode?
Yeah.
The characters in Portlandia, they're doing what I did a couple of years ago, went way, way too far, way too fast with Battlestar Galactica, the best binge show probably ever made. Laura Hudson is culture and entertainment editor for Wired Magazine and has binge-watched many a TV series. Laura?
Great to be here. Thank you.
Are you as guilty as I am? Somebody told me that you binge-watched Arrested Development yourself. Is that right?
Yeah, I've actually watched the entire new season 2 times at
this
point.
2 times. So you not only got drunk, you went back for some hair of the dog, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And it's definitely a television show that's made to be watched in this way to a certain degree. Although the creator, Mitch Hurwitz, has said he doesn't necessarily want everybody to binge watch, you know, all at once because he's worried about the effect that'll have on the humor. It's absolutely something where there's a cumulative effect to all of the callbacks and all of the references that you're seeing in the show that you wouldn't pick up on a week-to-week viewing of a traditional television show.
And it seems pretty clear that Netflix, which is distributing this and put it out all at once, look, they didn't put it out episode by episode. They dumped it on us. Why do they want us to binge view?
That's sort of the model that they've adopted. And it's the model that users have adopted as well. I mean, you notice it when the moment a show ends, there's an automatic play feature and a countdown begins to the next episode. So even if you have 10 seconds of hesitation, all of a sudden you find yourself watching the next episode. So I think for a lot of people, you know, even if they have that moment, it's going to push them to the next episode where, you know, rather than making a deliberate decision, all of a sudden they find themselves there watching it.
Laura Hudson from Wired Magazine. Does binge watching, though, dilute another great part of serial viewing, which is the cliffhanger or the big scene, you know, the big wedding? If you binge watch a season, there might be 3 big weddings instead of 1 per week. Doesn't it change the dynamics of what really works in a show? Is that sort of by design?
I think it definitely does change the dynamics of you know, the way that both the way that you should make a show and the way that you should experience a show. And I think that Arrested Development is a perfect example of something that's absolutely made for this medium, you know, because, and you find yourself over time when you're binge watching, everybody hits that point where they just sort of start pushing themselves to keep watching. And I think that's a very different feeling from anticipating something. So you remove that anticipation, you remove that period of time over which, you know, you're able to enjoy all of these plot points and all of these experiences, but also able to share them with other people. You know, there's the fact that being able to consume it at whatever rate you want also puts you out of sync with everybody else, because there's no one time that a cliffhanger happens at. So when do you talk about it around the water cooler?
And when do you make sure that you not kill somebody else with a spoiler or make sure to stay away from Twitter? These are all part of the pitfalls of modern binge viewing. Hey, Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, Boardwalk Empire, I'm guilty of them all. Laura Hudson is culture and entertainment editor at Wired. She is guilty as charged binge viewing Arrested Development. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, there seems little doubt now after the leaks and the reporting that President Obama is fixing to nominate a former Justice Department official who served under President George W. Bush and a Republican to head up the FBI. James Comey was deputy attorney general during the former Bush administration. He was also a federal prosecutor for the Southern District of New York. There's been no official announcement about Comey's nomination from the White House, but NPR broke the news after talking with sources who apparently have knowledge about the search for the new FBI director. The current director, Robert Mueller, is leaving his job in September. That's by law. He has to go. Here with us to explain what this all means is Ronald Kessler. He's written extensively about the FBI. He's author of the New York Times bestseller, The Secrets of the FBI. Hi, Ronald.
Hey, good to be with you.
Who is James Comey? He's a Republican, as I mentioned, but some people might remember him from some of the more contentious days of the Bush Justice Department.
He really appeals to both sides of the political spectrum because, on the one hand, he was appointed by President Bush. On the other hand, he stood up to Bush on the NSA intercepts issue, which involved one aspect of the intercepts, and those intercepts continued, but he objected to the process that was in play at the time, wanted more safeguards, and stood up to the Bush administration, threatened to resign. Bob Mueller, the current FBI director, backed him in that and said he would resign as well unless these changes were made. So that tells you a lot about his character, his principles. I know that Bob Mueller is a big fan of Comey, and that's, I think, a very good sign because, in my opinion, Mueller has been the best FBI director. He's totally changed the direction of the Bureau. There really have been no abuses found. It's true that they didn't uncover the Boston Marathon bomber.
Right.
But, you simply can't get everything. And the reason for that was that Justice Department guidelines would have precluded continuing the investigation into this brother.
And Congress is looking into that issue now. Let's listen to James Comey in his own words on the wiretapping that you discussed, Ronald Kessler.
As acting attorney general, I would not certify the program as to its legality. We had concerns as to our ability to certify its legality, and which was our obligation for the program to be renewed.
Ronald Kessler, James Comey not only objected to that program being renewed, but it's widely reported now that he physically intervened in a hospital room in Washington, D.C. when Alberto Gonzalez and other Bush administration officials went to try to get an ailing John Ashcroft to renew that program. It was quite dramatic.
Oh, dramatic to say the least. Comey was acting attorney general while Ashcroft was in the hospital, and yet the Bush people wanted Ashcroft to sign off on this program because Comey would not. So really an amazing episode, and definitely will inure to his credit when it comes to confirmation hearings. But beyond that, he has the experience that I think you need to be FBI director, namely extensive involvement in the prosecution side, being a lawyer, being involved in FBI investigations. That is so critical because what the FBI does is so complex now, and you absolutely can't go in there not knowing what you're doing. And I think he will go in with the requisite knowledge. He will be respected. At the same time, I think the fact that he's an outsider is a good thing. I don't think it's a good idea to have an FBI agent become director because that individual may be beholden to various interests within the Bureau or want to protect certain agents. It's good to have an outsider. So I really think this is a perfect appointment. I think it's admirable that President Obama didn't purposely choose a black or purposely choose a woman just to make a political point. He really chose someone who I think all sides will agree is the best candidate.
We haven't had that choice officially from the White House yet, but we are getting reports that that James Comey will be the next FBI director. Ronald Kessler, who's written extensively about the FBI, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Secrets of the FBI. Ronald, thank you.
Thank you.
Trouble at Facebook now, after the company has been forced to admit that it failed to take down misogynistic images and language This week's admission came after a campaign led by feminist advocacy groups to crack down on Facebook user content that glorifies violence against women. For instance, here's an example. The less than delicately titled page, "Violently Raping Your Friend Just for Laughs," end quote, named in the group's letter to Facebook. The campaign lasted a week but quickly gained traction under the hashtag FBRape. It even convinced advertisers like Nissan and other companies to, at least temporarily, pull their ads off of Facebook after users sent screen grabs of corporate ads right next to graphic images and violent images of women in question on Facebook. Lindy West writes for Jezebel.com. Nancy Willard is director of the Center for Safe and Responsible Internet Use. Lindy and Nancy, welcome to you both.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Good to have you. Let me start off with a statement from Facebook that I know you're familiar with. This comes from Facebook. In recent days, it has become clear that our systems to identify and remove hate speech have failed to work as effectively as we would like, particularly around issues of gender-based hate. We need to do better, and we will. Lindy West from Jezebel, that statement says what to you? Satisfactory at this point? They made a mistake and they're correcting it?
I mean, I don't know if they will actually correct it, but it's certainly encouraging to have a major corporation basically acknowledge the existence of rape culture and that we have and that they had a persistent blind spot when it came to gender-based violence.
Nancy Willard, Facebook is, of course, a big free speech zone. And in big free speech zones, bad language, hate speech sometimes comes out. What's amazing about this situation is the speed and effectiveness on the internet that the backlash had against Facebook and their advertisers.
I think you're quite right. It's very amazing. First of all, the compliments to the advocacy group that ran this campaign. And then secondly, I was very impressed with the speed and substance of Facebook's response.
And their advertisers as well. I mean, I think what was most effective about this wasn't pressuring Facebook, but pressuring Facebook's money. Isn't that right?
This is true. It's actually all about branding and the strategy of capturing images of advertisements next to this kind of negative material was exceptionally effective. Now, I would add that people who post this kind of negative material might want to reflect a little bit on their own personal branding, because if you're known as someone who posts this kind of material or likes this kind of material, posts a favorable comment, that also affects your brand, can very well affect your career, and can affect your relationships. So on Facebook, it's actually all about branding.
Well, Lindy West, I want to get to free speech and hate speech in a second. But before we do, what about Facebook's advertisers? It's one thing to have a lot of people on the internet with hashtags very effectively call attention to an issue and make advertisers head for the hills. That's business. A little bit troubling that they didn't notice for themselves in the first place that a place like Nissan or another company doesn't have somebody monitoring this and that they didn't notice for themselves.
Well, I don't know how you would monitor all of Facebook because it's kind of, I mean, the internet's kind of a wilderness.
Right.
But I do think it's troubling that it takes, you know, the threat of money being taken away to get anyone to take notice of these things rather than, you know, hundreds of thousands of women saying, hey, could you not rape and sexually exploit us anymore? You know.
But do you think that Facebook's response at least was rapid and effective? They didn't backpedal and sort of prevaricate, right?
Or no. They? Yeah. I mean, it seemed pretty good to me. Yeah. It was at least rapid. And I hope that it'll be effective. I mean, someone's telling these Facebook moderators what to do and what to take down. Someone was telling them, take down images of women breastfeeding. Don't take down images of dead women bleeding. You know, so at least the acknowledgement that that's a problem is a step somewhere.
Nancy Willard, we have to talk about free speech in the context of hate speech, of course. Facebook is a big free speech zone. Hate speech isn't illegal, of course. And as we all know, under the First Amendment, we hear a lot of things that we would rather not hear. Pressuring advertisers is, of course, fair game in the world of media and politics. But asking Facebook to ban certain sites or ban speech. Isn't that a little troubling?
Well, we have to take a minute and understand what free speech really means. Free speech is a provision in constitutions that prevent the government from restricting certain speech. Facebook has no obligation whatsoever to protect people's free speech. Facebook is a company that has set up a website. They've set up their own playground, and since it's their playground, they get to play by the rules. I mean, they may have billions of users, but they're not a country. I think what's happened in this situation, I've watched Facebook ever since the very, very beginnings, because I do pay attention to digital safety issues. Facebook was set up by a bunch of young men, and their original the original site had all of the qualities and the values of a group of young male college techies, and I think the original approach taken on these images is a vestige of that sort of adolescent male kind of attitude.
And maybe that's Facebook. Maybe that's changing pretty quickly. Before we let you go, Lindy West, let me ask you. It's true, Facebook is a private company, described by Nancy Willard as a playground. Nobody should appreciate hate speech, and certainly not the implications therein. But should I want to play in a playground where certain speech is banned that I can just ignore as an adult?
Well, I guess it's up to you. I mean, I don't know if banning certain speech, like the idea that anyone's being censored, is the right way to think about it. I think about it as we socially police ourselves all the time in all kinds of directions. And there are some of these same people would have a fainting spell if you posted a TV spoiler. You know what I mean? But then they have no, but then a dead woman with a hilarious caption is just mm-hmm. comedy. So, I mean, I just feel like if it's a community, you can police the community without shutting down free speech. I just don't think free speech is in jeopardy.
Well, part of the Facebook community has certainly policed that playground using internet reaction hashtags and such, forced several large sponsors to back away from Facebook. And now Facebook has quickly backed down on policing hate speech, especially against women and projecting violence against women on its website. Lindy West, writer at Jezebel and author of the book How to Be a Person. Also Nancy Willard, director for the Center for Safe and Responsible Internet Use. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Very welcome. Thank you.
We're going to leave you this hour in Mexico City, where we've been visiting this week. There are really ugly sounds. And then there are just ugly sounds. I'm playing an electric guitar made out of guns. Pieces of guns. Clips from AK-47s. Barrels from rifles and 9mm pistols. It's an art project and the inspiration of Pedro Reyes, a trained architect whose answer to the drug violence in his country is to turn weapons into music.
It's very curious because it's not something that you can really draw and then build. It's very hands-on. And it's about like taking these parts of guns, etc., laying them on a table, and then if you see this, the shapes, it's more like a random or kind of a fortuitous serendipities. No, you find something that combines with this part and that part, and then you come up with a design.
So I see Uzi here. You see Glockenspiel.
Uh huh. Exactly, that's one potential use that we'll find for it.
That such a beautiful sound could come from guns used in the drug wars is precisely the idea that Reyes wants people to think about, taking power over violence by transforming weapons into something harmless but still powerful.
I would say that the transformation is very powerful because, I mean, obviously these guns have taken many lives. What I'm very impressed is that guns have a very lasting life. You know, like there's not like no planned obsolescence. They continue to work for generations, no? And these guns have killed more than once, no? It's, who knows how much suffering have they created. So it's like a feeling of taking that sheer might that the weapons have and making that into an instrument. It's very interesting because it's like the transformation is not only about the metal becoming like something different. There's like a kind of psychological transformation and a social transformation. I mean, that feeling of impotence is suddenly reversed, and what we want is like we're waging a cultural war, because I mean we believe that guns don't need advertisement in magazines, etc., because they have the best advertisement agency, that is Hollywood and video games. And the way that they are presented in pop culture as something sexy, as something cool, is something that ought to change. And that's a cultural war, and that's a war that we're fighting with music.
Let's talk about Mexico for a moment. You've just described how your art makes you feel powerful in the face of something that makes people feel very powerless, the violence here. This feels like a moment of awakening in Mexico right now. You talk about power through art. It also seems like there's a political change going on right now, a sense of economic hope. What's happening in Mexico right now?
Well, there's a lot of work to do because we have just ended an administration period where there was this escalation of violence, and somehow there's a critical mass that now is aware that there are certain things that didn't work. And change has to come from all sectors of society. It's not that we can only expect solutions to come from the government. We also believe that as a creative people and as a civic sector, etc., we also have to do something. So, and I believe that this is something that you have to do between all sectors of society, like the private sector, you know, and the civilians and the government have to come together. And especially in the issue of violence, it's not that you can always say, oh, what we need is more police, more jail, more security. So that we saw didn't work. Interesting statistic was that in Chihuahua, the only week of the year that no deaths were reported was the week of a massive musical festival. And it's because all families were out, people took the streets, and that makes a community safer. So culture may have a bigger impact in the reduction of gun-related deaths than just like sending more army and more police, you know? So what we're trying to do with music is to use these events and show that, you know, if you can choose between a machine gun or an electric guitar, you'd rather go for an electric guitar.
Do you think that right now in Mexico there's a turning of the page where various sectors of society are saying in their own way, we're done with that, we want something different, and that some kind of cultural unity is really an antidote to a lot of the problems that Mexico has faced in the last decade?
Yes, I'm very positive about the coming years. However, we have still to elaborate several issues. No, I believe that one of the most important things is to really have a change in the policy towards the war on drugs, because it's proven that it has wielded terrible results. So I believe that legalization would kind of help reduce violence. And also, we have to stop the flow of weapons into Mexico. And for that, we need the help of the United States. And because it's a shared problem, you know, it's also a shared pain. When people say it's not guns that kill people, it's people who kill people, it's important to remember that it's a combination of guns and poverty that is like a kind of a recipe for disaster. And there's a lot of poverty in the United States as well as in Mexico. Without guns, we would be safer. And that's why we need to really embrace a change where, you know, you should make some sacrifices of your personal liberties towards a greater good.
Do you have a favorite? You got a name for one of these?
Well, we have come with very crazy names. For instance, there's one instrument called the Kalashnikov clock that is made of 12 clips of AK-47s. And it's like a marimba, sort of xylophone. And, these weapons, most of them are designed for exclusive army use. No, they're assault weapons. You know, the big problem is that they are so widely available now that obviously it's a big effort to try to take them out of circulation.
All right, Pedro Reyes, it's been great talking to you.
My pleasure.
Pedro Reyes is an architect turned artist. His latest exhibit, Disarm, features weapons turned into musical instruments. His work will be on display in Pittsburgh later this year. Todd?
Well, John, you're making music with guns there in Mexico. Where are you off to next?
Well, we've got a humanitarian story about a struggle to find someone who disappeared in the violent last decade in Mexico. Also, how high can you stack expressways? Some ways this city may be repeating its mistakes.
Also tomorrow, John, from here in New York, it's Friday, of course, so Kristen and Rafer will be here to run down the weekend's movies. Give us your take at 8778MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm John Hockenberry in Mexico. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.